And good morning. It is Friday morning, and you're listening to WOWDLP Tacoma Park. This is Danny Griffin, and this hour, Tacoma Radio's 10th special on climate change with my co-host, Julie Hantman. The brains behind the whole series. I'm the pretty face. Climate seasons. What is our topic? And I'm hoping that Julie is there. Julie, are you there, please?
I am here.
Excellent.
Thank you, Danny. Yep. And again, I'm Julie Hantman. I'm a storyteller, public health advocate, climate advocate, longtime resident of D.C., and invented this show about 2 years ago to give everyone a little dose of climate change in a way that's kind of palatable. It's tough stuff, so we hang together. And every 3 months is a different topic. Today, our special is called Act Fast, Joe. The need, obviously, for Biden to act straight out of the gate to confront the climate crisis. I have with me our guest for today. Her name is Jean Hsu. She's an attorney and director of the Energy Justice Program at the Center for Biological Diversity. So hi, Jean, and welcome to the show.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me.
All right.
Yes.
Okay. Well, yeah, I just want to make sure. I got a call in to the office of the president-elect to make sure that he's listening. So just want to get a confirmation from there. But should we have an interlude before we get started?
Sure. Let's do that. And don't worry, I tagged him, so I know he's listening.
Okay, great. All right. We'll be back in a moment with Julie Hantman and Jean Hsu for this today's version, December, the last of 2020, climate seasons.
That I got a lot of water all over me. I have oceans with lobsters, whales, otters. 3/4 of me is covered in water. I orbit the sun.
I'm so hot.
That's his line. And the moon orbits
it's
me.
It's my time to shine.
I'm filled with life, both big and small. The most beautiful planet of all.
Such a beautiful, such a beautiful, such a beautiful, beautiful world.
You're listening to Tacoma Radio, and with my co-host, Julie Hantman, and our latest climate special entitled Act Fast, Joe. Please, Julie and Jean, take it away.
Okay. So my first question, Jean, is, can you briefly explain the term energy justice, which is in your title? Also, what pulls you to do climate work?
Oh, great. Well, thank you so much for having me again. And those are beautiful questions, absolutely gorgeous questions. So energy justice is actually a somewhat relatively new term to hit all of us. But its roots, of course, are very deep in the country. When people are talking about our new climate future, a lot of folks think that it is sufficient just to switch out a fracked gas plant for a renewable energy plant on public lands. And they view it really as a technical solution and how to mitigate our carbon. But actually, our new energy system needs to be far, far deeper and systemic than just technical switches. Basically, energy justice is about tackling the energy injustices and really the violence that has been embedded in our fossil fuel infrastructure against communities and especially communities of color in this country. And so when we talk about a new energy future, it not only has to be technical, which, you know, of course, it has to be clean, but it also has to be just towards those communities. We're hoping that it is democratic and that it is ultimately resilient. What that looks like in a lot of places across the country right now are community solar and rooftop solar programs that really have the technical capacity to, you know, really nip the carbon question in the bud, but has those essential justice elements for communities as well as ecosystems. So it's very nuanced, as well as really hits and addresses the deep systemic problems of racism and inequity in the country.
Mm-hmm. So it enables people, whatever their wealth or identity backgrounds, to be able to either afford to go renewable or to benefit from the systems you set up around them so that it's a whole of population approach.
Yes, absolutely. So one of the really interesting, well, heartbreaking parts about COVID is the revelation of so much energy violence that is perpetuated on communities in this country. So one of the things that we have been working on tirelessly throughout this year is to preserve people's basic human rights to electricity. Because of COVID and because of the economic downturn, we all know that millions of Americans lost their livelihoods. But with that, we see that they're losing their homes if they're renting them. But if they can actually retain their homes, they are losing access to basic human rights of electricity, water, and broadband. And so we've been, you know, fighting for that. And it really just echoes how energy fragile these communities are. They are, you know, disproportionately low wealth. They are losing their electricity at a time where heat and air conditioning are literally the ways to get through climate disasters. And so, you know, we've been really, you know, pushing on that end for energy justice in that sense, where we can get long-term resilient systems like community solar so that people can actually be resilient at the end of the day and really fight back against centralized utilities and fossil fuel practices that have been poisoning communities for so long, as well as really jacking up rates and exploiting communities of color. It is a level of fragility that keeps hitting people down, especially poor people across the world. And it stops them from actually rising up and making substantial change. The climate emergency has been here for decades and has devastated so many people across the globe, as well as inside the United States. And there hasn't been enough voice given to that type of climate injustice, which ultimately is why I'm pulled to this work.
This is a very natural pivot. The reason I initially scheduled this interview with Jean was this chock full model executive order that you were at the lead of, which nearly 400 organizations signed onto, that she presented to the Biden-Harris transition team this week, I think a couple days ago. And there's a lot in there about how Biden can utilize executive powers to fight climate change and that he ought to do that ASAP. The creme de la creme, I think, on it is this, hey, declare climate change a national emergency. Tell me, Jean, what would that do if he did declare climate change a national emergency?
Yeah, so the number one thing in this executive order is for President Biden on day one, we would hope even in his inauguration speech, to declare a climate emergency. There have been over 30 countries in the world now that have declared climate an emergency. It is so intuitive, as you're saying, Julie. And here in the United States, it would have two functions. One is really just the political statement of grabbing everybody, you know, really shaking them by the shoulders, the entire country, and naming this crisis, this true global existential crisis, an emergency. And it gets all of us in gear for understanding that we need to move everything as fast as possible to combat this emergency. So just giving that political sheen over this crisis is absolutely vital. The second thing that it does is that it actually triggers legally a series of statutes that could be used to combat the climate emergency. And so I am a lawyer, and Julie and I noted that we did not want to get into too much legalese or policy here. But there are some critical, very important and bold things that if President Biden declared a climate emergency, he would be able to do, for example, ban all crude oil exports leaving this country, which would be a huge win for fossil fuel fighters. We focus a lot in our executive order on the incredible clean energy revolutionary actions that could be taken with emergency powers. And I'm happy to go into that more, but maybe I'll stop there, Julie, for the moment.
To add another dimension, I think the UN Secretary General is calling on countries to do this.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And some many have done so. So it's sort of the trend, the moment. Let's see, we'll go to a break soon. But yeah, just why don't you just throw out a sort of a general characterization of the executive order? Is this stuff that the Obama people just never thought of?
Yeah, pretty much. One of the powerful things about this executive order and what we're calling for is that all of these actions are actually actions that can be taken under existing law. The president doesn't need to rely on Congress for these types of actions. And that's really kind of the clincher here. We don't know what's going to happen in Georgia. We hope and pray that it will turn Dem, which will be amazing. But ultimately, we're not guaranteed that. And so we're really looking at what powers the president currently has that Congress already gave him. And there's actually so many key ones that can be taken for the climate emergency. Julie asked me to break this down more simply, and essentially in the executive order, there's three sets of actions that could be taken. One is being extremely aggressive and progressive about stopping fossil fuel extraction. Those are actions and statutory powers that the president has. President Biden actually already promised that he would stop and ban all new oil and gas leasing on federal lands. So we're hoping that we can hold him to that promise. So stopping fossil fuel extraction and phasing it out is absolutely the number one type of action that he can do. And then on top of that, he has incredible powers to address systemic environmental injustices in the way that agencies approach and think about and can mitigate environmental injustices. And the third, of course, is how he can trigger a true clean energy revolution. A couple of things that I'd love to point out in this executive order is that the president actually has the ability to, for example, redirect military funds to promote and build out renewable energy. So what we saw in the Trump administration, which I personally litigated against, was how the Trump administration abused a certain emergency power to redirect military funds to build the border wall. If you legally use that type of power, we can actually redirect military funds to build renewable energy out on military properties, government properties. This is, everything from large rooftop solar installations all the way to electric vehicle stations. If you can imagine, at every single U.S. post office around the world or around the country. So this is a huge and important power to really leverage government property and government systems to become a driver of our new clean energy future.
Tremendous. Okay, Jean, thank you. We're going to go to a musical clip, and next up after that, we'll talk a little about some of the announcements that President-elect Biden made just yesterday or this week about some of the people he wants to head up his climate team.
And I just want to let everybody know, you're listening to Tacoma Radio, and this is the December version of Climate Seasons. And it's a show conceived and hosted by Julie Hantman, and we're speaking today with energy activist Jean Hsu. The wolf is at the door.
Sea levels rising. The far right's on the rise. And still it seems that people just refuse to open their eyes. The wolf is at the door. Show you the wolf's inside. This is our decline. The wolf is at the door, and you act like you're doing fine. This is it. This is our decline.
In all honesty, I am incredibly stressed out about systemic climate change, and I don't know what the solution is.
Corporate greed is choking us, and they pretend.
And you're listening to Tacoma Radio. This is Climate Seasons, and we're speaking with host Julie Hantman and her guest, energy justice activist Jean Hsu. And we're talking about the immediate steps that the Biden administration could take on climate change. Okay, take it away.
All right. Again, this is Julie. And I just want to give a shout out to that piece called Wolf is at the Door by Alex Goldman. He's host of the Reply All podcast. Biden knows that climate change is a crisis. He's gotten more and more clear about that and acting. He announced his climate team, or hoped for climate team, this week. Cabinet secretaries that, of course, would have to be approved by Senate, other leaders across government, and taking, he says, a whole of government approach to climate crisis. I'd love just to hear, Gene, your thoughts about this list of folks. Would this be a highly progressive slate or moderate?
You know, I think that we can all agree that this is just a tremendously historical slate. We have now the first Native American woman, the first Native American to head up DOI, Department of Interior. That is beautiful and so historic. I think if we all take a step back and just, you know, as we're saying goodbye to 2020, it has been an extraordinary year of so many cracks in the country opening up. All the George Floyd protests, you know, for us here in D.C., being out on Black Lives Matter Plaza, just all of this is culminating to a point of, you know, where we now have our first African-American and Asian vice president. And we have very carefully picked cabinet choices. So I think on that level, for folks who've been fighting for this type of representational equity for a long time, this is a truly tremendous moment. But I think, you know, we also have to be a bit clear here as well. Many of the cabinet picks are not particularly, you know, super progressive on climate, or at the very least, you know, have a mixed record in some circumstances. And it doesn't mean that they certainly won't get there or can't get there. It's actually all of our jobs, the folks who've been fighting for this, and hopefully everyone in America, to really push for that type of progressive action. So, you know, I think this is just a wonderful door opening to that public pressure and people power to drive these folks to take very, very bold action.
Yeah, I have seen that there is a plan that there be a 90-day cabinet-level task force to write a new four-year climate ambition agenda or climate plan. Is that fast enough for you, or you want these executive actions to happen essentially on day one or week one? Why not wait and work through and with the wisdom and passion of multiple new people?
Yeah, the Climate 21 plan is a collection of folks who've been in agencies for a very long time, really kind of reconstituting broken agencies. That is probably the most important part about it. It is actually reconstituting agencies that have felt really broken over the last 4 years. So it's almost, in a lot of ways, I think it's important because it's getting you back to a place of sanity for people to function. And it does have some good, you know, solid climate actions in it. I think what we are looking for is something that goes beyond that, and that is transformational. Everything that we have put forth in our plans are, you know, really ideas that have gone beyond what the Obama administration was thinking about. And we're really pushing for people coming out the door with that greater political ambition and courage to be far bolder than any other administration has ever been. So I think plans like Climate 21 and ours certainly work together to basically put our ducks in a row and really pursuing super bold things that past administrations haven't thought of.
Can I ask you a question, Gene?
Yeah.
What would you say to the moderate, you know, wing of the Democratic Party that's saying, look, well, you know, we just got through like a Holocaust here. Maybe, you know, this isn't the time to be so aggressively progressive or progressively aggressive. Or how would you respond to that? The cautionary that let's not to get too green too quick.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that we are in the middle of, maybe this is the wrong term to use, but a climate Holocaust in and of itself, and there is actually no time to lose. Basically, what's happened in the last 4 years is that we have lost such deeply, deeply precious time to combat the climate emergency. We are actually on a ticking time bomb right now. Every year that is lost actually has significant, dire consequences for not only folks in the States, but all over the world. So, you know, what I say to folks is, my goodness, we have had 4 years of rollback. But right now, it is most important as ever that we get out and move as fast as possible. And one of the really, you know, important things about this year in particular is that we've seen how fed up people are with how things are, from everything, the energy status quo, the incredible wealth disparities in this country. There is so much political appetite right now for true change, which is why we've seen the Biden administration, or the Bernies of the world and the AOCs come out. And if we do not seize this moment right now, we are missing an incredible opportunity. And I'd also say, you know, coming out of COVID, this country has been destructed economically. And one of the most important ways that we can get people back into jobs, but like good labor union jobs, is by pretty much igniting a very fast clean energy revolution and mobilizing on a war scale level to beat this.
Hooray.
Yeah. Where do I sign up?
Wow. Where can people find this executive order?
Yeah. So actually, you can find it on a website that we host separately, and it's www.climatepresident.org. And that's where you can find not only the executive order, but the 70-page legal document that we wrote to support every single statutory authority, and over 500 groups last year endorsed this platform. So that's where we can sign up, and that's where we are building the movement with so many other movement partners and other spaces that are fighting for climate justice as well as environmental justice and racial justice for the country.
Jean, could you spell your website? It's just it's a little bit easier for folks at home. Say it and then spell it.
Sure. Okay, great. So really easy to remember, Climate President. We basically need President Biden to be the climate president because we have no more time to waste on the climate emergency. So it is just climatepresident.org, www.climatepresident.org.
Great.
And this brings me back to my spelling bee days, so thank you.
That's correct. And now use it in a sentence.
Find those. What's going on? All right. And you can also find some of those links in the resources section in my website where I house this and other episodes. So that's climateseasons.org is my website, and I list that there. One more just almost complaint that I will lodge, and then we'll go to a musical break. Moderate, progressive, far left. Couldn't we just blow up, you know, these distinctions, since we are in this moment, as you're talking about, of the need for radical action or a strong action, whatever you want to call it?
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with you 4,000%, Julie. We have been so divided on so many levels on this end. AOC said something, you know, pretty profound a while ago. She said, if I were in any other country, we would never be part of the same party. And I think, you know, the branding and like scarlet lettering of progressives in this country is just a lot of bullshit. And we really need to just unify at this moment. And everything matters. Every single, you know, conversation that you have with somebody, every single op-ed, LTE that you put out there, every single sign-on letter that you sign on to, and every single protest you go to, all of that matters. And that's why, you know, speaking especially to the incredible activists in the DC area, the DMV area, everything that you did this year mattered. And we need to keep that pressure on. We have absolutely no time to waste. This is the moment.
And this is Tacoma Radio. I'm Julie Hantman with Climate Seasons, and our current episode today, Act Fast, Joe, with our guest Jean Sue from the Center for Biological Diversity. Before we go to the break, I'll just say that we're going to head back in with a discussion of the Fair Share proposal that Jean and other organizations have developed. And it's very bold when it comes to both domestic and global promises. Next, on Top of the World, Imagine Dragons.
You
And welcome. This is Climate Seasons, and it's the latest episode with Julie Hantman and her guest, energy justice activist Jean Hsu. Welcome back, guys.
Hey, thanks, Danny. This is Julie Hantman, and we're back with Jean Hsu, and we're going into another conversation. As I've been saying, there's this executive order that her organization, Center for Biological Diversity, and almost 400 others have come together and pushed toward the White House to consider. And one of those pieces is called the Fair Share Proposal. So can you please break that down, Jean?
Wonderful. So very talented researchers and economists teamed up to basically figure out fair shares. They pretty much assign shares to every single country around the world based on two factors. One was current emissions as well as historical emissions. And the second thing that they looked at was financial capacity. How wealthy are you? And can you actually help Global South countries, impoverished countries that are feeling the brunt of climate change without causing it? And the third is the morality factor, that the reason why we should be assigning shares is because it's had the right thing to do when we are facing this global problem. One of the most inequitable and simple ways to think about this is that the United States is the number one historical emitter, and yet its contribution to fighting the global climate crisis is far, far, far from what's needed. And the few are suffering the most from it in the global south are, you know, the ones who are, whose houses are being blown away from floods, who are, facing hunger because of new food issues with climate change, climate migrants who are, displaced persons around the world. All of these people have some of the lowest emissions in the world, and yet they are the ones who are feeling the brunt of the climate crisis. So all of those things came together, and I ended up teaming up with these folks, this group of awesome analysts and economists, to present this year what we call the U.S. Fair Share, the updated one. And what that looks like is that it's basically broken down into two buckets. So the first bucket is, for us to achieve a limit of 1.5 degrees warming, the U.S. has to cut its domestic emissions by 70% by 2030. That's a very ambitious and tall order, and it is in line with the U.S. fair share. The second thing that it goes into is not only cutting down our domestic emissions, but really feeding out into the world internationally what the U.S. has to give to help the global south deal with climate change. It's basically cutting another 125% of the equivalent of U.S. emissions in the global south, essentially, by giving extensive financial and technical support on climate. So those two together will fill the U.S.'s fair share towards the world on the climate catastrophe.
Another 125%. I kind of get it, but has anyone calculated the dollar amount that might be talking about?
Yes, absolutely. We're actually just looking at billion metric tons of CO2. Mm-hmm. And so that on an international level means that we are on the hook for helping abate 9 billion metric tons of CO2. So how are we going to do that? There's a couple of different ways. One is really putting money where our mouth is and actually getting funds out there to help transform energy systems, to help with adaptation, and to help folks. Tons of actually sub-Saharan African countries are in talks internationally to think about leapfrogging coal and natural and fracked gas and just going directly to solar. The other thing that the U.S. can totally do is give technical support and technical products. One of the very cool things that we're pushing in our executive order is actually the use of the Defense Production Act to manufacture clean energy products and make the U.S. a real superstar, a new and rising superstar in that new clean energy market. If folks don't remember, you may have heard that the Defense Production Act this year, because the Trump administration refused to use that and really marshal domestic industry to make personal protective equipment so that our essential workers won't die. And so the Trump administration refused to do that. It is a really key set of powers that would allow the U.S. to ignite a manufacturing market for clean energy. And we'd be able to actually help push that out into the world through technical assistance and aid. And that will also help us fulfill our fair share.
Wow. A beautiful logic there.
There is logic. Yes.
And the morality piece is fascinating. You think of pragmatism. What's moral about this? Accountability for the historical emissions, and then capacity that we can afford this.
Yeah.
You have to look back and also say, who's got the deepest pockets?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, the heartbreaking part about the climate emergency is that every single, you know, fracked gas plant that we build, every single time that it is burned to, you know, light up our light bulbs, that's going into the world, and it's turning into the devastating hurricanes and floods that are causing people to die. And so I think that, you know, with that global moral problem, it's just so intuitive and heart-wrenching.
It's even hard for me, being involved in climate, after the 4 years of the Trump administration, where it almost sounded like our air, our climate, our whatever is just ours, right? Right? U.S. first. It's even hard to wrap our heads around, yes, everything we do affects the climate, and we need to think that way. And it's hard even on the news when you hear about these horrible, even wildfires decimating parts of California. It's hard to think this affects me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will say that the agency that has been at the forefront of understanding those connections is, shockingly, but not shockingly, the Department of Defense. The Department of Defense has, for two decades now, pumped out reports talking about the dangers of climate change, how the U.S. is fueling that, how that is fueling wars across the world, and how that will come to bite the U.S. domestically in the bum later. They have been at the forefront of mitigating their own emissions, as well as trying to figure out how to ramp up defense, you know, in other places. They have tried to get away from fossil fuels, essentially, because of all the defense issues and war issues that have, you know, caused the wars we've gone into to fight for oil. And, you know, they have put solar panels and distributed energy on their ships, on their planes, on their buildings. And so, you know, I think when you think about it, even from that very, you know, traditionally conservative viewpoint, the climate emergency is a national defense, national security issue. And so everything that we do here to mitigate that is, you know, not only for domestic reasons, but for international reasons that ultimately are trying to help us here and keep us safe.
Thank you, Jean. Jean Sue of the Center for Biological Diversity. Amazing work you are doing in concert with other allies. You can see the entire model executive order and legal basis at climatepresident.org. That's climatepresidentaltogether.org. I'm Julie Hantman, and you can check out my past episodes of Climate Seasons at climateseasons.org. That's all one word, climateseasons.org. And the archived recording of this show will post in about a week. Danny Griffin, thank you so much for helping make this happen.
My pleasure.
And I think, yeah, thanks. And thanks to Tacoma Radio for making space for these tough conversations.
I'm coming to the edge of the widest canyon. my companions, dear. I'm starting to question my manifest destiny, my claim to this frontier. I'm coming to